are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Wednesday, October 25th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the phone today, on the show today, via phone. Wow. From Mother Jones Magazine, Ari Berman. On the voter suppression that threw Wisconsin to Trump. Meanwhile, Jeff Flake announces he can't win re-election, says the obvious about Trump, and hailed as a saint. Then later, Republicans, including Flake and Corker, vote to crush your right to fight banks and despicable financial services in the courts. And tax cuts for wealthy is just another way to say the Republicans are family. North Korea talks break down. Trump administration ordered to allow young immigrant to get an abortion. Republican House leaders take away Dana Rohrabacher's travel allowance. And the majority of white Americans believe whites face discrimination.
Tell me about it.
And finally, Scotty B is back. Scott Brown in hot New Zealand water.
But also discriminated against in
totally,
a certain way.
Totally discriminated against.
Total discrimination.
All this and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a lot of stuff to get to today. And I would be lying if I told you that I want to spend the entire day talking about Scott Brown. It has been too long. And just a small two lines of quotes from him. He is just so wonderfully stupid. But we're not going to do that for a while. We're going to have to wait until the fun half of the program until we get there.
The fun half. Am I right?
Dude. Please. Place. Who knows? Maybe for Halloween we'll do a deep expose into the dark forces that are trying to take out Scotty B.
I feel an urge. A similar line.
You imagine doing just like literally like a 45-minute film on like video breakdown of like the machinations. Maybe that's what we'll do.
You know what's messed up is I can't.
That's actually a great idea. All right. I'm going to try and maintain my level of anger here. I'm so pissed about this. Yesterday in the Senate, and we'll talk about how, you know, honestly, I think people who follow this show long enough know that I tend not to swear very much because of my time on the radio. But F Jeff Flake. Let me just put that. I don't care. And I will talk to Ari Berman about this. And I hope he's not going to tell me how historic it is that Jeff Flake got up in the Senate and said something critical of Donald Trump. Listen, if you see any commentator say that what Jeff Flake did is historic, that is the biggest sign for you never to listen to that commentator again. Because not only is it not historic, nobody's going to remember it in 6 days. Unless Jeff Flake keeps coming out and saying the same thing, because he's not going to do anything whatsoever that is going to make whatsoever difference. The Republicans are not going to impeach Donald Trump. They're not going to do it. If anything, the only thing that Jeff Flake is doing is A, enhancing his brand so that when he leaves the Senate, he'll have a wealth of opportunities, and I do mean wealth. And B, maybe he's also enhancing the brand of the Republican Party by trying to make it like, well, they were trapped by their own voters. That's what we always hear about Republicans, right? They're trapped by their own voters. That's why they have to act this way. It is the most childish perspective of politics possibly. Jeff Flake is not a hero. We'll get into it more. No, play this clip of Jeff Flake. Play this clip of Jeff Flake.
Let's never regard as normal the regular and casual undermining of our democratic norms and ideals. We must never meekly accept the daily sundering of our country. The personal attacks, the threats against principles, freedoms, and institution, the flagrant disregard for truth and decency, the reckless provocations, most often for the pettiest and most personal reasons, reasons having nothing whatsoever to do with the fortunes of the people that we have been elected to serve. None of these appalling features of our current politics should ever be regarded as normal. We must never allow ourselves to lapse into thinking that that is just the way things are now.
So we are living, if I am to understand Jeff Flake, in a time that is not normal. We cannot normalize this. We cannot behave normally. We cannot function normally. We must, at every moment, remind everyone this is extraordinary. And therefore, I will vote with Donald Trump 100% of the time. 100% of the time. He is doing nothing. Nothing. If it's not so, if it's not normal, if it's so extraordinary, why not call for an impeachment in that speech? Why wait for that speech? Why wait for that speech when you basically are announcing, I know I can't win re-election, so, and the best you can come up with is just say, like, Donald Trump's not normal? Is this some type of revelation that we're supposed to understand? Or is it we're supposed to give him so much credit? In fact, not only is Jeff Flake not going out there and not calling for impeachment, he is specifically not calling for impeachment when they ask him about it. So I guess it's like, it's not normal, but it's not that crazy. It's just somewhere between normal and not normal and not crazy. And then you sprinkle a little bit of like, it looks like I'm not going to win my reelection. And so I'm rebranding. And historians are coming on television telling you this is a historic speech. The best you can make out of this is that the Republican Party, the people who vote for Republicans, are also not normal. Jeff Flake, to in any way, and here's the other part. I get embracing allies. He's not an ally. He's not doing anything that helps. And there's no response from the center or center left that is in any way helpful to anything. Jeff Flake doesn't give an F about what my response to him is. Jeff Flake doesn't give an F about what anybody's response is to him, other than the people who are going to hire him later. Maybe he has an opportunity to run for governor in Arizona 2 or 3 years from now after Donald Trump has, you know, caused the Republicans to lose maybe the House. That's his bet. But I'm sorry. He lobbied for apartheid in South Africa. He got 100% rating from the Club for Growth when he went in and the Heritage Foundation. Your support of Jeff Flake, your raising him up, is not going to help your agenda one iota. He's not going to help bring about impeachment. In fact, all he's doing is edifying the notion of, like, you're only, it's really too much to ask of any Republican who's actually going to run for election to do this. So give me a break. Scumbag. In that, I haven't even had the opportunity to express my anger about the vote last night. 51-50, Mike Pence came jaunting down. Remember all that stuff we've been talking about with that Wells Fargo? You came in, you signed up for a savings account. They put you into a credit card account. They put you into some other account. You know, what we would think is almost like sort of criminal. Well, not only apparently will there be no actions there, maybe they'll get a punishment from the attorney general. You do not have the right to sue them. Because when you signed up for that savings account, you checked off a little box, or you didn't even check it off a box. It was in there on page 43 of the small print that you didn't read because you're a normal human being, that said that they are subject to arbitration. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau had issued a regulation, said that you can't do that. Wells Fargo, hey, Equifax, you can't trick people into going into arbitration because you've asked them to sign up for something to fix what you broke. They can sue you. That's what the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau did. And last night, the Senate, House had already voted, the Senate, under the Congressional Review Act, which is not filibusterable, voted to destroy that regulation. And know something, under the Consumer Congressional Review Act, that regulation cannot come back through regulatory process. It can only come back now via a statute passed by Congress, which of course is subject to the filibuster. So bye-bye, your right to go into court against banding with other people. Because, look, no lawyer is going to take your case if you got cheated out of $1,500. And it's certainly going to happen more because we just gave a green light to these banks and financial institutions and whatnot to go ahead and do it, because there's really no way for citizens now to band together and make you pay a price that makes those practices not worth it to you. There are consequences, folks. Mike Pence, 51st vote. He's the vice president. He was on the ticket with Donald Trump. I'm spelling this out because there's some people out there who are still so stupid about this stuff. Government actually means something. It's not just like a reflection of how you feel about yourself. All right, we got to take a quick break. Speak to Ari Berman.
Chris Hayes.
Stop. All right, we'll be right back.
I didn't say anything.
Some things we don't want.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure always, always to bring Ari Berman onto the show. He is now at Mother Jones. Ari Berman, what is your position at Mother Jones now?
I am a senior reporter at Mother Jones, Sam.
I'll say. I will say so.
Once you become 35, you're a senior for life.
Well, I got news for you.
It's like the AARP of journalism.
You, as far as I'm concerned, you earned your seniority a long time ago, buddy.
I'm still a journalist at 35, so therefore I am a senior reporter.
No one has been on the voting rights question more than you over the past, it feels like now, 8 years. Maybe I've got that wrong. Maybe it's five. But starting with the what happened with the Voting Rights Act and everything that we're experiencing, I don't know, maybe this is an overstatement, but it seems to me that everything that we're experiencing in terms of the suppression of votes in this country is in some way a function of that Supreme Court ruling. Is that fair to say?
Well, I think there were two major things that happened. The first is that after the 2010 election, so many states passed new restrictions on voting, both traditionally red states, but also a lot of really important swing states like Wisconsin and Florida and Ohio and Pennsylvania. And then in 2013, the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act. And those states with the longest history of discrimination, primarily in the South but not exclusively, were able to implement new voter suppression laws without federal oversight. So it's really those two things combined, the explosion of voter suppression efforts after the 2010 election in response to President Obama's election, and then the Supreme Court making it much easier for these states to get these voter suppression laws approved in the future.
And I was thinking about this the other day, too, as I was reading your piece. And I imagine the dynamic has shifted under Jeff Sessions, of course, where I can only imagine what it's like to be in the civil rights division of the DOJ now. It just must be.
There is no civil rights division in the DOJ now.
Right. And during the Obama administration, I would also imagine that the absence of the preclearance provision for all intents and purposes meant that those cases, it limited the capacity of the Civil Rights Division in the DOJ to get to other cases that they would otherwise get to because they had to put that much more work into the most egregious cases that might have been taken care of by the preclearance measures.
Exactly. So formally, if Texas or North Carolina passed a voter suppression law, they could block that law before it even went into effect if it was discriminatory. So that required a lot of work, but not nearly as much work as filing a law and filing a suit against the law, going to trial, and going through a 3 to 4 or 5 year process, which is what they had to do in Texas and North Carolina. So basically, the Department of Justice spent so much time on these two cases in Texas and North Carolina where they filed suit against restrictive voting laws, they weren't able to litigate in a lot of other places like Wisconsin. And I think it was kind of a chicken and egg thing because before the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act, they were being fairly cautious because they were worried about the Supreme Court gutting the Voting Rights Act. And then when the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act, that took away the most effective tool the federal government had to block these kind of voting restrictions. So they were, I think the Obama Civil Rights Division did a lot of good, but I also think they were hamstrung by the Supreme Court's decision during their entire time. And that really meant that, you know, other groups like the ACLU and the Lawyers for Committee for Civil Rights and the Brennan Center for Justice had to pick up the slack. And they were successful in some cases. In other cases, really bad laws were able to go into effect because conservative judges heard them. And these conservative judges decided that they were going to approve things like voter ID in Wisconsin, even if the evidence was very strong that it was discriminatory and should be blocked.
Let's talk about your cover piece. I believe it's a cover piece, right? In Mother Jones. You went to Wisconsin. You've analyzed the numbers. Broadly speaking, we know that Donald Trump, for all of the mistakes that certainly I have credited Hillary Clinton with making in Wisconsin and in other places, the difference in Donald Trump's win was about, what, 20,000 votes. Is that right?
22,700 votes.
And walk us through why, even with all of the mistakes that Hillary Clinton may have made, at the end of the day, there was just simply far less voters who had the right to vote than she needed in Wisconsin. And this, I guess, presumably would have also impacted Russ Feingold.
Yeah. So, I mean, I say very clearly in the piece, there wasn't one thing that swung the election. I talk about James Comey and Russian interference and racism and sexism and Hillary Clinton not running a good campaign and not visiting Wisconsin, all of those things. So I say very clearly in the piece, there wasn't one thing that did it. However, it's true that in Wisconsin, voter suppression played a very important role. When Wisconsin passed a strict voter ID law in 2011, meaning you had to have a Wisconsin driver's license or state ID to be able to vote, a federal court found that 9% of the electorate, which was 300,000 voters, didn't have these strict forms of ID. And a lot of people had trouble getting them because after the election, the University of Wisconsin did a very comprehensive study of people who didn't vote in 2016 in Milwaukee and Madison, the two most Democratic areas of the state. And one in 10 people who didn't vote in 2016 said that the voter ID law was a reason why they didn't vote. And 6% said it was the main reason why they didn't vote. And so that means up to 23,000 people were blocked or deterred from voting in Madison and Milwaukee alone because of the voter ID law, which is larger than Trump's margin of victory. If you extrapolate statewide, that means that up to 45,000 people didn't vote because of this voter ID law. We know that Wisconsin had a very significant drop in voter turnout. It's historically been number two or number one in voter turnout, but they had a 3.3% decline in voter turnout. And half the decline in voter turnout occurred in Milwaukee, where 70% of African Americans in the state live. And the head of elections in Milwaukee told me that he believes that the voter ID law had a significant impact in Milwaukee, because if you look at the numbers, turnout in Milwaukee declined only slightly in white middle-class areas of the city, but it declined sharply in black low-income areas. And some of that was because President Obama was on the ballot, but some of that was also because of the voter ID law, because African Americans were more likely to live in poverty, they were more likely to move, they were more likely to move from other states like Illinois where their IDs weren't accepted. So for all of that reason, the voter ID law hit them more sharply than others. And I talk about these stories in the piece. I talk about a woman named Andrea Anthony, for example, who's a 37-year-old African American woman from Milwaukee who had voted in every previous election. She lost her driver's license before the election, like a few days before the election. She showed up at the polls with a different form of ID from Wisconsin, her proof of residence. She was registered to vote. She had voted at this very polling place during the primary in Wisconsin, so everyone knew who she was, but she wasn't able to cast a ballot. And the only way her ballot would have counted is was if she went to the DMV to get a new ID and then to the Board of Elections within 72 hours after the election, which she couldn't do because she was working a full-time job. And so this one person who had voted her entire life wasn't able to vote. And not only that, but both her niece, her daughter and her nephew weren't able to vote at all because they also didn't have the right ID. So, I mean, here you have three people in one family that wanted to vote but weren't able to. So clearly a lack of enthusiasm for Hillary Clinton wasn't the only factor at play in Wisconsin.
Yeah, I mean, has anybody done any data? I mean, I guess this is really one of the most comprehensive looks into just who gets locked out. I mean, when we talk about specifically where it's not just sort of an algorithm, but when we're actually talking about specifically who gets locked out of the vote in these circumstances, I would imagine, just based upon your reporting here and maybe just sort of like intuition, that the median income of someone who is locked out of voting because of a voting ID law has got to be significantly lower than maybe even the voting population.
Well, that's absolutely true, because, I mean, if you look at people who don't have a driver's license, for example, they are more likely to rely on public transportation, so they're more likely to live in urban areas. They're more likely to be lower income because they don't have a car. They're probably more likely to move often, so they don't have ready access to documents like a birth certificate, which you would need to get an ID in many states. And so for all of these reasons, voter ID is both a race and a class issue. And race and class mix together in a city like Milwaukee, where you have a heavily African-American population living in poverty. And this is what all of the statistical analyses show. We know a lot about these laws now because there have been so many trials about them. And we know very clearly that lower income people are more likely, are less likely to possess these forms of IDs, and African Americans are more likely to possess these IDs. They also, the law was written in such a way to exclude certain people. So even people who aren't low income were targeted by the law, for example, college students, because college IDs were not accepted. And so you had a situation where, not to get too technical, but they wrote the law in such a way that for college IDs to be accepted, they had to have a 2-year expiration date. Well, why would the University of Wisconsin, which is a 4-year school, issue an ID with a 2-year expiration date? And that makes absolutely no sense. And so the legislature specifically wrote the law to prevent University of Wisconsin-Madison and all the other schools in the UW system from being able to use their IDs to vote, meaning that those schools had to had to print in completely separate IDs just for students to use to vote, which was a totally clear example of how the legislature was targeting young people. Also, to give you an example about how African Americans in Milwaukee were targeted, Wisconsin ran voter ID ads about the voter ID law in 52 movie theaters around the state. Not a single ad ran in a movie theater in the city of Milwaukee, where 70% of African Americans live. Not only that, as the head of elections in Milwaukee told me, how many people who live in poverty are going to see a movie in the first place? So, I mean, this is the kind of stuff that when you have to kind of dig a little bit deeper into the law, and then you realize how it was really intended to target some people and not others.
But wasn't there a specific edict from the judge in these cases that, like, okay, you need to, there is a baseline of information that must be provided to get people the ideas or the IDs, or there must be a baseline of effort. I mean, was it, what was that? And what was the baseline? Was it based on results or was it based upon efforts?
Well, so this is really interesting. So the voter ID law in Wisconsin was initially blocked because the federal court found it was discriminatory and because he found there was no evidence of fraud to justify it. Wisconsin didn't present a single case of voter impersonation in court that the law would have stopped. So there was no evidence of voter impersonation in Wisconsin in any previous election. Then that opinion was overturned by a conservative appeals court, which included judges who are on Donald Trump's Supreme Court shortlist. And they basically said, the state of Wisconsin has promised they're going to make it easier to get IDs, so therefore the law is constitutional. The state of Wisconsin did absolutely nothing, though, because what I and others found was that people were going to the DMVs and they were not getting the IDs they needed. And I tell it a story like this in the piece of a guy by the name of Zach Moore, who was a 35-year-old African-American man who moved from Chicago to Wisconsin. And he had got a job in Madison, but then he was unemployed, he broke his leg, and then he became homeless. But he was a pretty well-put-together guy, and he went to the DMV, and he brought his Illinois ID, he brought his Social Security card, and he brought his proof of residence to verify that he lived in Wisconsin. And there was a huge sign at the DMV that said, no birth certificate, no problem. Meaning if you didn't have your birth certificate, you could still get a Wisconsin ID to be able to vote. So he goes up to the clerk, he says, I have all my documents, I want to get a Wisconsin ID. And they said, and they told him, you need to go back to Illinois and get your birth certificate. Even though there was a sign right where he was standing at the DMV that said, no birth certificate, no problem. This guy was homeless. He was unemployed. He was in no position to go back to Illinois, pay for a bus ride, try to find his birth certificate and go back, come back to Wisconsin. And so a federal judge ordered an investigation and found that the process for issuing IDs in Wisconsin was, in his words, a wretched failure. And he said, undeniably, people have been disenfranchised. So what I say in my piece was that this voter ID law was a slow motion train wreck. Everyone saw the crash coming on election day because of all the evidence that had been gathered in the run-up to the election, but nobody could do anything about it because the state of Wisconsin either was incompetent about implementing the law or, in my view, specifically implemented the law in a way that made it hard for certain people to vote because that was the whole purpose of the law in the first place.
So if that's the last ruling, and I want to get to in a moment outside efforts to deal with this law as it stands, but what from a legal perspective, what's the next step? I mean, if this judge realizes like, hey, this is BS, and I think you talk about other examples of people going in and recording their experiences and trying to get licenses, it seems to me there's plenty of evidence that the state has not upheld its end of the bargain. What's the next step from a legal perspective?
Well, the judge did everything he thought he could to try to get Wisconsin to amend its procedures to make it easier for people to get IDs, but this did not trickle down to voters. Most voters are not election law junkies, and they don't know when the law changes. A lot of them didn't even know about the law in the first place because Wisconsin did nothing to advertise it. And so this, the lower court judge was really hamstrung by the conservative appeals court that reinstated Wisconsin's voter ID law. The Supreme Court decided to hear the case. This is a textbook example, Sam. I know we've talked about this a million times on your show, of why courts matter. And not just the Supreme Court. Most cases never even get to the Supreme Court. This is why district courts matter. This is why appeals courts, even more importantly, matter. And this is what I'm so concerned about under Donald Trump, that he's already put more people on the court than President Obama put in his entire first year. And he's putting absolutely crazy people on the court who are totally unqualified and have really terrible records. And for all the dysfunction about Trump, all the talk about how he's not doing anything, this is exactly what they're doing. They're putting people on the courts like Neil Gorsuch, like a bunch of mini Scalias in the lower courts who are going to be there for 30 or 40 years and put voter ID laws and other restrictions on voting in effect, even if the evidence is overwhelming that they're discriminatory, that they're unnecessary, that the state's not even complying with their own stated procedures when it comes to implementing the law.
All right. So the much of that seems to be sort of, I wouldn't say set in stone, but it's set in, you know, at least a fairly durable plaster at this point. Let's talk about, because you talk about this in the piece, there's basically a new strategy from voting rights advocates that is outside of the, I don't want to say outside the legal system, but is not going to pursue the remedy through the legal system, but is rather going to take the laws as they stand and aid people in getting compliant, which, of course, is much more expensive, much more difficult to do, you know, to go around and make direct contact with 20,000, 40,000, 50,000 people who need assistance in getting their IDs. But give me a sense of that.
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, the ACLU and other voting rights groups haven't dropped the litigation they're doing, but I think they've recognized the litigation isn't enough. And particularly with Donald Trump appointing judges, it's going to become harder to litigate against these laws. And so what the ACLU is doing is now funding this really dynamic organizer named Molly McGrath, who has worked in Wisconsin for a long time and is from there, to help people get IDs in Wisconsin and other states. And she's only one person, but she's going to try to scale this up. The ACLU membership has quadrupled since the 2016 election to 1.6 million members. They're now doing this new campaign called Let People Vote, where all 50 states in their local state chapters are launching voting rights efforts, whether it's changing a law in the state legislature or fighting voter ID laws. They're all doing something. And what they're trying to do is use this quote-unquote people power to actually help voters on the ground, to make it easier to register to vote, to help people get IDs. And that's not going to be able to overcome all of the voter suppression laws, but I think that the courts are not going to be enough. I think you have to fight these laws at the grassroots level, and I think ultimately we're going to need a political solution here. We're going to need different state legislators, different secretaries of state, different attorney generals to try to change these laws, because with all the focus on the presidency and the Congress, and obviously that's very important, the states have really been where this fight has been. And that's not really getting any attention now with all of the focus on Trump.
What about a state like Michigan? Michigan, you had, I think, a difference of even less, maybe 11,000, was it, in Michigan, was the margin of the vote, somewhere around there. What is the state of Michigan's voting laws, and is what's happening in Wisconsin with Molly McGrath, is that being replicated in other states?
Yeah, they're trying to replicate it. Michigan didn't have as many voting problems in Wisconsin, but there were some problems. A bunch of voting machines just broke in Detroit, basically, and there are still questions about the vote there. Michigan has also been trying to pass a more restrictive voter ID law. They abandoned this effort, but I think they're going to try again. Michigan was the closest state in the country in 2016, even closer than Wisconsin. So I fully expect that Republicans there, in advance of the 2018 or 2020 elections, are going to try to restrict voting rights. We're seeing it in a bunch of other states. I mean, I talk about this in my piece. I mean, whether it was cutting early voting in black areas in North Carolina, or purging people from the voting rolls in Ohio, or disenfranchising ex-offenders in Florida, a bunch of states had these new voter suppression measures in place. I think Wisconsin is the clearest example of the impact of these laws because the law was so bad and the outcome was so close. But I think these laws had an impact in other states. And I think if you look at where Democrats need to pick up seats in 2018, both to take back the House and also to pick up state legislative races, there are a lot of states with new voter suppression laws, whether it's in Florida or Ohio or Wisconsin. So people are going to have to confront these laws head on in the next election, or else I think this problem is going to get worse.
You know, the amazing thing about this is it's a bit of a stealth technique, right? Because most people don't even think about it. They're not aware of whether or not it's difficult to get an ID. I mean, it's a bit of a pain. I got to renew my license. That's a drag, but I can go in. It's not the I have the flexibility to schedule when I go in. I have, you know, whatever the $35 is not an issue for me to go and pay. And it's basically like a stealth issue, right? I mean, it's hard to get. I imagine in Wisconsin, you could ask the average person, like, you have a problem with the voting restrictions, and they'd be like, no, I don't see what the issue is.
Well, of course not. And that's the thing is, if 90% of the public has something, of course they're going to support it. Not 90% of the public is going to support it, but a large majority is going to support it because they think everyone has the same documents they do. The thing is, though, 10% of the public doesn't have these documents. And for the 10% that doesn't have it, which is a huge number of people, hundreds of thousands of people in a state like Wisconsin, it can be very burdensome. And that's why I hope people read my article, because they see the struggles that people face, where if you just move somewhere and you don't have stable residency, you don't have proof of residence, so you can't register to vote. Or if you move from Illinois and you don't have your birth certificate, it's very hard to get a Wisconsin ID to be able to vote. Or if you move from out of state and you want to get rid of your driver's license, get a new driver's license, you have to pay money for it, which is a functional poll tax. And so there are all of these reasons why someone might not have the quote unquote right ID. Because everyone says, well, you need an ID to be able to get on a plane or buy alcohol. And what I tell them is everyone has some sort of ID. They just don't have the quote unquote right ID, right? They can't vote with their Illinois photo ID in Wisconsin. They can't use their University of Wisconsin ID because it's not accepted. And so Wisconsin has been very, very targeted in terms of what they allow and what they don't allow to make their law among the strictest in the country. I will just say that there's also some very clear evidence of the partisan purpose here.
Of course.
When the law was debated behind closed doors, Republicans said that they wanted to stop, quote, neighborhoods around Milwaukee and college campuses across the state from voting. On the day
I remember when that guy, I think you're about to mention it. I remember that interview live. I feel like it was on NBC or CNN or something.
The night of Wisconsin's primary, Glenn Grothman, a Republican congressman from Wisconsin, was asked why he thought that a Republican would win the state of Wisconsin after Barack Obama won it by 7 points in 2012. And he said, Hillary Clinton is the weakest candidate we've ever had, and now we have photo ID, and photo ID is going to make a difference as well. I mean, so everyone knew this was coming, and everyone knew what this law was about. We had both behind-closed-door testimony and very public comments to the effect of photo ID was passed to help Republicans win elections in a very crucial swing state. And so, I mean, the evidence supports it. My reporting supports it. But all you have to do is look at the public comments to see what was behind this law.
All right. I can't encourage people enough to read this piece because it really does explain to people the various different scenarios that make it very hard for people to vote. Let me ask you one more question just before we talk about just what's in the news. And I know you got to get out of here soon, but University of Wisconsin, do they now make a decision like, you know what, we're going to start issuing 2-year expiration on IDs?
No, I mean, they had to print completely separate IDs to be able to vote. This was such a huge pain in the ass. The schools had to print totally separate IDs. They had to tell people they need to get ID. Students had to know. They had to go to a completely different place on campus.
But going forward, are they going to change it?
I mean, no, they're not. The legislature is not going to change it. This is just going to happen.
Will the school change it? Will the school make their
ID? The school might eventually change their IDs, but it makes no sense to print a 2-year ID at a 4-year school, Sam. I mean, that's ridiculous. That's like that makes absolutely no sense at all, that people then have to renew their ID, their student IDs halfway through their 4-year term. So, I mean, maybe they have to do that, but we already have a situation where at our best, only half of young people vote.
right,
for one reason or another. And then you throw all these new obstacles in their way. And of course, turnout's going to go down because only the most motivated kids are going to go through this hassle of printing out their dorm list for proof of residency, getting an entirely separate ID, making sure they have Wisconsin residency. I mean, it's not impossible to do, but it's just like three or four more steps if you're already not that crazy right about a candidate. A lot of young people weren't that crazy about Hillary Clinton. So they said, you know what? Fuck it. I'm just not going to bother. And that was the whole purpose of the law. Sometimes there's just outright suppression. You just block everyone from voting. Sometimes you just make it so difficult that people just say, why bother? And I think a lot of that happened in Wisconsin as well.
All right. So let's just turn for a moment. I don't know if they've already started to put Jeff Flake on Mount Rushmore at this point. If they've already started to chip away at the rocks to, you know, but what did you watch any of the coverage of this last night? Like you, like historians coming on saying this is people, historians are going to write about this. I don't think anybody's going to be talking about this in 5 days.
So I was on the West Coast and I had meetings all day. So I only caught snippets of what happened, but I will say, I think that the entire conventional wisdom about this is wrong. I think this is a huge victory for Trump because he is chasing his critics out of the Republican Party. The fact that Bob Corker is retiring, the fact that Jeff Flake is retiring, that shows that Trump is winning. Trump and Bannon are winning the fight to make remake the Republican Party in the mold of Trump and Trumpism. And the very things that we hate about Trump, Sam, that's exactly why the Republican base likes him.
Exactly.
And he's incredibly popular among Republicans. So the fact that Jeff Flake has voted with Trump on every major issue, including, you know, Neil Gorsuch and healthcare and taxes and all of these things. So he's not even a dissident when it comes to the votes. But secondly, he's being run out of town. So I don't see how you can frame this at all as the beginning of a Republican insurrection. This is, if anything, more of a Republican purge.
Of course.
Of Trump critics.
Of course. All he's doing is saying, like, I give up. This party is. And the amazing thing about it is there is no like you say, there's no ideological daylight between Jeff Flake and Donald Trump. I mean, maybe Jeff Flake
maybe
has to
immigration
be,
in a few
I
issues,
was going to say, but, maybe yeah, because he's in Arizona and has so many potential Latin voters that he has to be more measured than the rest of his party on immigration. But aside from that, there's virtually no daylight in terms of ideology. And you can see it through his voting record. And it's really just a question of, I don't know, style. They're mad at him. To the extent that Republicans have abandoned Jeff Flake, it's not because his rating from the Heritage Foundation dropped by 12% or something, that his Club for Growth rating dropped by 12%. That's all. They think he's a rhino.
I don't like to make predictions after I lost a bet with you during the 2012 election. But I'm willing to
bet.
We
made it in 2011, but that's all right.
I don't think that the Republican Party is ever going to abandon Donald Trump.
No, I totally agree. They're never going to impeach him.
It's never going to happen. All of these things of John Kasich and other people running against him. He may decide he doesn't want to run again in 2020 because he becomes so unpopular and he hates being president. But they're never going to abandon him. They're going to stick with this guy to the absolute end. The Republican Party loves Trump. They love Trumpism. They love the racism. They love the sexism. All the things that we find repulsive about Trump, that's what the Republican base loves about him. So Jeff Flake, Bob Corker, no one's going to remember them. They're not going to be in the history books. Donald Trump is going to be in the history books for being the worst president ever and for Republicans sticking by him that entire time. That's what's going to be in the history books.
Jeff Flake said to CBS this morning, I don't think removing Trump is the direction to go. What is this guy doing? All he's doing is basically saying, like, hey, I can't win re-election. And if you're out there and you're looking for a former senator to hire who is a little bit more palatable to some of your high-end clientele, look at me. I mean, that's basically
I will say the only good thing that comes out of the Trump, the Flake thing is I think it's more likely a Democrat won't be able to hold that seat, win that seat now. So maybe it does change the Senate map a little bit. But it's hard to see how chasing someone who's a Trump critic out of the Congress is anything but a victory for Trump. I think Trump is right when he tweets about this. I hate to say it, but I think he's right.
All right. Lastly, I would agree with you. I think it ups the chances of a Democrat winning that seat. And also, you know, John McCain's seat is, I would say, is probably going to become vacant in the next year and a half.
Can I just say, Sam, if not for Jim Comey's letter, there's a very good chance Hillary Clinton wins Arizona in 2016.
Right. Right.
Or it's within 1 or 2 points, meaning the state is bluer than we think.
Yes. And I would also add that when you have Jeff Flake coming out like this, it holds the Democratic caucus together. You know, we had that horrible vote last night on arbitration. And I think David Dayan wrote that he was sort of shocked that there was not a single Democratic defection. And I think part of it is when you've got any Republicans going out there saying that type of thing, I think the only time we see the impact of Donald Trump and all of the, Michigas around Donald Trump is that it makes it harder for a Democrat to defect.
Yeah, I think that's right. Okay, I got to go catch a flight, Sam.
All right, buddy. Thank you so much. I
appreciate
the time.
Great to talk to you as always. Thank you so much.
We will link your piece at majority.fm. Ari Berman, ladies and gentlemen, the great Ari Berman, who still really owes me over $200. Thanks, Ari. I appreciate it.
By all my appearances on this
show. I don't even want to hear it. I don't want to hear the excuses. I don't want to. He wants to pay it off. He wants to pay it off per appearance. Sorry, doesn't work that way, buddy. I'm sitting here right now. He's basically just worked off the interest. This is a bet from 2011, for God's sakes. I don't think he remembers it, but I think we did a double or nothing. But I can't remember what it was on, and I don't think I won that. All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to head into the fun half. Sean Hannity has a real gem today for us that we will be playing. Tomi Lahren, is she on Fox and Friends? She did she get a new job?
She's a contributor.
Oh, did she get hired by Fox? Oh, well, that's good for her. I'm glad to hear that. I was a little concerned. Folks, yesterday, maybe we'll play a clip from one man's farmer's experience in Kansas with the Kansas miracle, as we call it, and the miracle is that some Republicans finally realized that trickle-down economics is a joke. That's the miracle.
The problem is that I don't think he understands the velocity of money.
Again, want to apologize to Canada. We'll introduce you to our new ambassador to your great country. I want to be a little bit tentative with Canada because at one point they're going to build a wall and we're all going to be on the wrong side of it. So we get some Alex Jones, all this and more coming up on the fun half, folks. Listen, this is very important. MajoritySurvey.com. If you clicked on the link yesterday on the blog, it was the wrong link, and you filled it out, fill it out again. You'll notice immediately that it's a different survey. Go to MajoritySurvey.com. It doesn't matter how you listen to this program or watch this program. There is a survey for you. If you're a member, there's a member survey. If you just listen to the free half of the show, I should have said this up front early, but if you just listen to the free half of the show, please click on it. If you watch the show on YouTube live, go to the majoritysurvey.com, majoritysurvey.com. Click on your appropriate link. Fill out the survey. This is not a survey by some type of ad broker that is helping us with ads. It's not about demographics. It is for us to get a better sense of who you are. I know who some of you are, but I want to get a sense of who the others of you are. And so it would be a huge help to us. I want an 87% response rate on this, which means that you're all basically, of all our listeners, we have a basic notion of how big I want thousands upon thousands of responses to the survey. Matt's looking at me like, what do you mean by that? And it's usually what they say is oh, if you get a 3% open rate or something like
that.
Yeah,
I was going to say 87 seems ambitious.
It's super ambitious.
It's like the concept of training for the Olympics, and even if you don't get there, you're still in good shape. He's just trying to set the bar high, Matt.
Well,
and Matt's just immediately you don't throwing
give,
the cold
you don't
water
give away
on.
The, yeah,
just
exactly.
Like, yeah, that's
I take the
high.
Opposite approach. In
Matt's
way.
Like, I like to set a nice, stable set of objectives. So as an example, I've never filled out a survey in my goddamn life.
I'm trying to think what movie
have you ever
I just
filled
saw.
Out a survey in your life, Matt, for anything?
I have, yes.
That wasn't like mandatory.
Oh, I know what it sure. was. The Lost City of Z. I just watched that movie on the plane back from Vegas, and I had read the book. It was actually a guy I went to college with wrote the book. And there was, they had something in there that was like, I can't remember who said it. I think the wife of the guy who was trying to find the Lost City of Z. He didn't make it out of the jungle in the end. But it was something like a man's reach has to be further than they can grasp or something like that. And that's why I said 87%.
Sounds very inspiring.
I was inspired.
Yep.
I'm inspired.
And I presume it also works with women too. I mean, I would say probably man or woman.
yeah, whatever. Count
on all those female hosted podcasts, though, they just shoot for like 82%.
It's because
and
of their it's because of their brains.
87%.
It's the same reason that they can't code.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. Also, you can become a member and join themajorityreport.com. Also, if you missed it last night on the Michael Brooks show, that guy, Matt, came in this morning. He's like, do you know, what's that guy's name?
Hunter Matz.
Do you know Hunter Matz? I'm like, Hunter Matz, wasn't he on the show last night? He's like, yeah. No, that was really great.
I'm the world's biggest Hunter Matz or Matz fan.
Hunter Matz.
Yeah. Okay.
Hunter Matz. So check it out. Apparently... brain stuff.
Like, a lot of debunking IQ myths. And
he's
then,
like bizarro Sam Harris.
It's like if Sam Harris knew the latest science, was affable and charming, and actually had a decent social and educational mission behind what he was doing, he would be Hunter Matz.
Yes, the problem is he wouldn't exist.
Then he wouldn't exist. But right. but consider this a thought experiment.
Right, there you go.
I have to say, also in the post game, I got a Sam Harris caller, and it was very good, who challenged me to a thought experiment about an AI anti-Muslim machine. Which is pretty incredible.
I thought that was a bit. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. If you buy your crap from Amazon, the least you can do is buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. We also have a jet.com link there. You will notice no difference, but we will get a kickback. Thus, majorityreportkickback.com, 646-257-3920. Take your numbers, I mean calls, in a moment.
I give her my love, she says no. She says no, 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 no. 'Cause you're only a friend to me. Only a brother to me. She's a pretty little dog who says no. She knows I love her so. If I ask her to walk with me, she shakes her head at me. She's a pretty little doll who says no. Ask She says you're only afraid to me. Only a brother to me. She's a pretty little doll. She says no, 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 no. All the night time through, she says no, 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 no. If I ask her to